Let's get back to Genesis chapter number 11, where we are now going to transition into the story that is the bulk of the book of Genesis, which is the story of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the people group that the Israeli people are related to, and to whom promises were given that were now coming to fulfillment in the time of the reading of the book of Genesis by the Israeli people coming out of Egypt and heading for the promised land. So this book of beginnings, the book of Genesis, was clearly intended to help the Israeli people understand how the world came into existence, how it got screwed up, how all these different people groups came into existence and interacted with one another. But most importantly, how they, as a family group, as a people group, had started in Mesopotamia, but migrated outside of their people group's region, because they were Semites, how they migrated into Canaanite territory, which the Canaanites were Hamites, and how they even ended up in Egypt, deep into Hamite territory, and became slaves there for many generations before being freed by God and brought back to the promised land, the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So the book of Genesis is kind of a centering document. It helps these Exodus-era Jewish people, these Israelis, understand this is where we fit in. This is how our history makes sense. So the most recent thing that we saw was the breakup of the singular civilization at the plain of Shinar, ancient Sumeria, ancient Babylonia, there in the heart of Mesopotamia, the land between the two major rivers of the Middle East, the Tigris and the Euphrates. When the Tower of Babel project was stopped by God, He did it by confusing their languages, which is where we now have the Jewish word Babel for confusion. The Sumerian language seems to have been associated with the idea of a gateway to God. And we know that that kind of came up back in chapter 11, verse 4, that they were planning on building this tower into heaven itself. And heaven was the place where they thought of God living. But God said, no, enough of that nonsense. You're not going to stay in one spot, and you're not going to come up here and invade my territory and try to stop me from being God. You all have your own languages now. Everybody spread out like I told you to. So the Hebrew language becomes the base language of the family we're now going to follow. It didn't exist previous to the Tower of Babel incident. It seems to have sprung up during the time of Eber. Chapter number 11, verse 10, goes back to the beginning of the Shemite line. But this time, it's going to follow only the line that brings about Abram, the main player in the next part of our story. And we also have some year assignments that help us to figure out the dating situation. That is, when did these events take place? Now, in my chronological companion to the Bible, which is a resource that's freely available to you on the intotheword.net website, there in the PDF resource section, I've told you several times that the anchor dating for events in the book of Genesis are clearly tied in to when Abraham Abram at that time, enters Canaan. And we know that that happened in 2101 BC. And so we can backtrack from there to put dates or years on some of these events as to when babies are born and things of that nature. And so under that understanding and using the Greek numbers for this, because I think they're much preferable, the birth of Eber, who was alive at the time of the Tower of Babel, that happens in 2911 BC. His son, Peleg, whose name means division or divided, his son, Eber, was born in 2777. So it seems as if the Tower of Babel incident must happen somewhere around 2778, 2779, 2780 BC, somewhere in that vicinity. And it's interesting that that's approximately when we start seeing civilizations pop up in Mesopotamia and in Egypt and over in India. That these civilizations kind of see their sudden rise right in that general vicinity. And that seems to be attributed to the scattering by God of these various peoples. Now, some of them may have migrated on their own. Others, God may have transported. That's a reality that we should acknowledge. But we're only going to follow one particular family line. And so let's read. Genesis 11, 10. These are the generations of Shem. When Shem was 100 years old, he fathered Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. So that puts us, I believe, 3306 BC, according to the Alexandrian Septuagint numbers, which means the flood was 3308. And again, that seems to match much better the evidence on the ground, the evidence in the historical books outside of the Bible. That seems to match much better than the numbers we see in the Masoretic text, which most of our English Bibles are based on. So Arpachshad lived 35 years. He lived 135 years, because remember, one of the problems between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint is that there seems to be a removal of 100 from some of these numbers, because apparently somebody along the line felt that that was too big of a number. So Arpachshad lived 135 years. He fathered Shelah. Arpachshad lived, after he fathered Shelah, 403 years, or it gets adjusted in the Septuagint, and had other sons and daughters. So we're multiplying here. Shelah lived 130 years, fathered Eber, and then he lived more after that, had other sons and daughters. And Eber lived 130 years is what the Septuagint has, and he fathers Peleg, which would have been right after the Tower of Babel incident. And Eber, he lived more years after that and had other sons and daughters. Reu lived 134 years, 130 years, and then he has more years after that, more sons and daughters, until we get down to verse 22. Serug was 132 years, 130 years, and he fathers Nahor. Now, this is where we start getting to names that will be important to us. Serug lived, after he'd fathered Nahor, more years, and he had other sons and daughters. So by this time, we've got a lot of people living on planet Earth again. Now, it's not as many as had been living on planet Earth the first go-round by this time of multiple generations, because they're living shorter and shorter lives. They're still living into their multiple hundreds, but it's getting shorter and shorter each generation. But Nahor, we are told in verse 24, lived 29 years. It's actually 79 in the Septuagint. And he fathered Dira. Now, Dira is important because he's the father of Abraham. So, Nahor lives more years after he fathers Dira. He had other sons and daughters. When Dira had lived 70 years, he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now, in our English reading of that, we would almost think that this was an example of triplets, but that is not the case. Because of other passages that we will come across soon, we know that Haran was the eldest son born to Terah, and that Abram and Nahor come later, and they probably have many other brothers and sisters that are not listed here. In fact, we know for a fact that Sarah is born to Terah from a wife other than the wife that bore Abram, and she's not listed in this genealogy list. And so what we need to understand is that even in this family group, there's a lot more information than what we have in the pages here. And the reason for that is all we need is the information necessary to make sense of later stories. Verse 27. Now these are the generations of Dira. Dira fathered Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. Now, the reason Abraham comes first is because he's the key player for the Israeli people. The reason Nahor comes second is because he also is a gene contributor to the Israeli people, because he has some children in his family that end up intermarrying with Abraham's family members. Haran has to be mentioned because of what is mentioned here at the end of verse 27. Haran fathered Lot, and we know Lot comes into the story of Abraham several different times. Verse 28, Haran died in the presence of his father, Dira, in the land of his kindred, in Ur of the Chaldeans. Now, we don't know exactly when Haran died, but it seems as if he died sooner than he should have, because he doesn't outlive his father. Now, where is he born, and where does he die? Well, Ur of the Chaldeans is very specifically mentioned here. It has been the traditional teaching in many of the commentaries that Ur is located down toward the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates river systems into what we call the Persian Gulf, that there was a culture there, a city there called Ur. And that's true, it was. But I don't think that's the Ur that is mentioned here. And here's my reason for that. In Josephus, who is a historian, a Jewish historian of the first century, he is retelling a lot of these stories out of the book of Genesis, but he keeps throwing long-term oral tradition and generational stories that have been passed down into his Antiquities of the Jews. But he also brings in stories from other historians of the region, where these events took place. And in his Antiquities, Book 1, Chapter Number 7, and Subsection 2, Josephus quotes from Nicholas of Damascus, who was a prevalent historian of that era, and said that the land of the Chaldeans was, quote, the land above Babylon, end quote. Now, when it says the land above Babylon, we know exactly where Babylon's at. We know where Babylonia is, and we know where the city of Babylon is located. Above there means upriver from there. So up the river of the Euphrates from Babylon, which means it is definitely not the Ur of many of the commentaries down at the mouth of the Tigris-Euphrates river system, because that would be below Babylon. And this actually matches much better some long-term tradition that Abram originated from a town in Turkey that is now known as Sanli Urfa. And you can actually hear the Ur component in the name there, can't you? Ur, by the way, is related to the word for light in this the ancient languages here. This city of Sanli Urfa, Turkey, you can look it up in Google Maps or look it up in Wikipedia or something, and you can find it very easily. It's situated in the northern portion of the drainage basin for the Balik River, which feeds into the Euphrates. And interestingly enough, it is not very far from the city of Haran, which plays a very specific part in the story that's coming up about how Abram is told by God to leave the land of his forefathers, the land of Ur of the Chaldeans, and travel to a place in Canaan, which God would show him very specific places later. Okay, so keep that in the back of your mind, that Ur of the Chaldees is actually a little bit north of the Haran of the story in Genesis we'll get to in a little bit. Verse 29 of Genesis chapter 11. Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. Now, Abram's name means great father or high father. And it might have been kind of an honor given by his father Terah to the recent death of his father Nahor, because that does seem to show up in the genealogical lists. Sarai's name means princess. Perfect name, right? That a father would give to a daughter. And they are half brother and sister. We'll find this out later, so I want to mention it now. They do not share the same mothers, but they do share the same father, Terah. Now, that doesn't cause a problem. As we've said before, in the ancient times, the gene pool was much deeper and wider, and so the problems of marrying people closely related to you were not quite as prominent. That will change over time. By the time we get to Moses and the writing of the commandments for the Jewish people, they will be told that they cannot marry half-sisters or half-brothers, that this is not appropriate, apparently, any longer. But in the time of Abram and Sarai, not a problem. So he marries his half-sister, which there's only about 9 years difference between them. And then the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, That would be their older brother. So Nahor marries his niece, who is probably about his same age, because this is one of those spread out families in age where the younger siblings are roughly the same age or even sometimes younger than the older siblings' kids. I actually grew up and went to school with a man who was older than his uncles, which was really weird. But that was how it kind of worked in his family. The name of Milcah and Iscah, they come into the story later. Verse 30, now Sarai was barren. She had no child. Now that's the important bit for the story of Abram and Sarai, is that they are married for apparently decades without kids. Now we know before the flood, it seems as if couples did not get married and start having families until right around the century mark. As we've been reading through these lists here, it seems as if that continued for a while after the flood, as the deterioration of age is happening. Very soon, we start seeing the age of children happening in under that century mark. The example in verse 26 was that Terah had his oldest boy, Haran, when he was 70. And so it would appear that Sarai and Abram are getting married probably 50s or 60s, and they don't have any kids. We know for a fact they didn't have any kids when they head off to the Promised Land, and that's when Abram is 75. All right, verse 31. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson. Now, from this, I gather that Lot is the ward of his grandfather, Terah, because Lot's dad, Haran, is dead. And so Terah calls the shots for his family, including those that are grown up, such as apparently Lot is grown up enough and Abram is grown up enough that they should be able to call their own shots. But because Terah is alive, he is the one that decides what the larger family is going to do. So Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, which is only about 30-some miles south of Sanli Urfa, which is, I think, the authentic Ur of the Chaldees, they came to Haran and they settled there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Now, this is where things get a little bit uncertain as to how things play out in detail. And the Scripture doesn't give us all the fine points. And so we have to surmise things on between-the-lines evidence. We know in chapter number 12 that we'll get to next session that God is the one that tells Abram, to leave his home country and his family and head to Canaan, to a land that he was going to show him as his new homeland. We know that that was directed to Abram. And yet here, in the tail end of chapter 11, we see that it was Terah who decided that his whole family should be heading down to Canaan. And how is that happening? Well, my best guess, and that's all it is that the call was actually given to Abram. But when Abram went to his father to ask permission to leave, which would have been appropriate, because even adult sons deferred to their fathers, that when he went to Terah and said, I've had a vision, I've had an encounter with God, the Creator, and he has told me that I should move south to Canaan. I believe that Terah basically said, if you had an encounter with God and he wants you to go to a new place, I want to go with you. I want to do what such a God would say. It is interesting that later in the book of Genesis, this is in chapter 31, verse number 53, that the Creator God, who's in this story here, is referred to as, quote, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor and the God of their father, end quote. Now, their father was Terah. So according to Genesis 31:53, Terah believed in the one true God. And that seems to be what prompted him to say, let's all go together. And they all take off from Ur of the Chaldees, but they only make it about a day's travel, about 30-some miles, to Haran, and something happens there that changes the people that end up going to Canaan.